On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Tarek Skubal, Team USA. I cannot believe those words just came out of my mouth. We run through all the pitching commitments that dropped this week for the WBC. We go around the league, a couple of interesting signings and a weird trade, and then we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that finally understands why baseball teams don't sign free agents over the age of 30. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and I pulled my back out at the gym this week.
Don't tell that to the Padres, who just committed a hefty sum to Michael King. We'll talk about that later. So much to get to on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast. And how fitting is it that our opener is an opener?
We spent our most recent show updating you on the goings-on related to the World Baseball Classic, specifically a number of commitments made by American players. Well, in the time since, the Team USA pitching picture has gotten a lot more interesting and unveiled. A number of names with talents far beyond what any of us expected have committed, at least right now, to playing in the World Baseball Classic this upcoming March. Between our last episode and right now, we have since gotten news that the following individuals will wear the stars and the stripes for the WBC. Joe Ryan, who Jake Mintz said would do it. I had no inside info. I'm just built that way. Logan Webb. There had been buzz about Logan Webb doing it. He's a great candidate. Clay Holmes. Sure. Nolan McLean, which is a very interesting one, Mets rookie, who only has 8 Major League Baseball starts. Mason Miller, the flame-throwing Padres reliever. And of course, most importantly, the consensus best pitcher in the universe and the world, and to pitch in the World Baseball Classic, Tarek Skubal. Jordan, what a haul. Unbeatable, untouchable. This rotation would win 173 games. Where do you want to start?
Oh, my goodness. A lot to get to here. First of all, I do like to imagine that there were people listening to our podcast earlier this week when I said on multiple occasions, like, I don't want to talk about the starting pitching because we're not going to get these commitments until much later. We're not going to know. And like, as they're listening to it, they're just getting all of these notifications that all these, it's like Mark DeRosa was listening. He's like, okay, Jordan, you freaking idiot. Watch this. Here's Tarek Skubal. Here's Logan Webb. Here's Joe Ryan. Here's Mason Miller. But let's get back to my very bad and lazy joke that I opened this opener with, which is just the premise of a starting rotation in this tournament. Now, I think that the very obvious and understandable base level reaction to this, and there's a lot involving Skubal in particular that we're certainly going to get into with a mini version of the Skobo coming up later. But let's just focus on like getting this amount of talent to commit as a starting pitcher where you are pitching in theory in max effort games, high stakes games in the middle / beginning of March, right? Like that's what the assignment is here. And they have, yeah.
You're underselling this a little bit. The first reaction is holy crap, right? The first reaction for me, I couldn't believe it. And yeah. we have talked about how Japan beating Team USA might in theory motivate mm-hmm. some of the best pitchers that are American to opt into the upcoming tournament. Because even though Team USA lost the final by a score of 3-2, people forget, the thing that really not doomed them, but was kind of the glaring issue is that the pitchers were just not good. You know, I'm pulling up the list of starters from the last tournament, and it was Lance Lynn, Nick Martinez, Miles Michaelis, Brady Singer, Adam Wainwright. Okay. there's not a fastball over 95 in that group. You know, Merrill Kelly. There's no heat there. Kyle Freeland, maybe he's got a little bit more sauce. But it is just an unbelievable upgrade. And we'll get into how much are each of these guys going to throw, how many innings, how many pitches, whatever. As far as I'm concerned, like, that's a first world problem. I mean, you have, is the upper crust of American pitchers that are available. And last time around, when names like Kershaw and Scherzer and DeGrom didn't show up, it didn't belittle the tournament. It didn't, but it was this like weird shadow over it in a way where it was like, these actually aren't the best players, right? Now the tournament made up for it because it was amazing and the games were great. Like no one was sitting there watching the final and being like, damn, I wish this sucks. Where's Max Scherzer? But like what we have now is going to be, it's just setting up to deliver an unbelievable addition to this tournament.
Yes. But I do think that the element of it, again, that I want to get back to is, and it's hard to say at this point, and we'll see how many more, because the other reaction is like, oh man, like who else can they get, you know? But also, how many more guys are you going to want to get from a starting pitching role? Because the reality is, there's not that many games in this tournament. And I do think that I have to imagine that behind the scenes for Mark DeRosa and Michael Hill and the people in charge of putting this team together, and also for the teams that are, you know, letting their players do this, we also have to remember that this is a player's decision. And yes, there is certainly a dialogue between team and player, certainly team and pitcher, involving participating in this tournament in the middle of spring training. But this is a player decision. At the same time, the roles in these games are not going to be normal. Like, they're just not. The most games you can really play in this tournament is 7 games. That's, of course, what USA and Japan, like, it's 4 games in pool play, and then quarters, semis, finals. You essentially have to cover 60, 65 innings, depending on how the game shakes out. You know, Talkin' Baseball puts out a projected rotation. This is just totally based on the names and the schedule. You see, okay, Paul Skeens versus Brazil, Tarek Skubal versus Great Britain, and so on. The pool play, they play in order: Brazil, Great Britain, Mexico, Italy. Quarterfinal will be against, we do know roughly who the quarterfinal will be against because of how the pools line up. It'll be against the Pool A winner or the Pool A runner-up. That's Puerto Rico, Cuba, Canada, Panama, Colombia.
If they get out of pool play.
If they get out of pool play, right? Which, okay, we're assuming they will. Last time along the way, they played Venezuela in the quarters, Cuba in the semis, and then Japan in the finals. I bring all this up just because, and I go back to, again, my joke about being an opener, how they navigate. Now you got the talent, you got the names, you got the arms, right? How do you game this out? How do you make sure your best pitchers are facing the best teams? Because do you even bother to have Paul Skeens, like, okay, great. If Paul Skeens faces Brazil, there is no way he is throwing more than 2 innings. There is no chance, right? And that's fine. They shouldn't need that. But, like, is the plan, if Mark DeRosa can have his way, to have the game against Japan be Paul Skeens for 4, Tarek Skubal for 4, Mason Miller for 1? I don't know. Like, maybe. But we still have to see how many more relievers are going to get and what the schedule is going to line up, because that is one of these starters at least is going to have to come out of the bullpen for almost certainly, because you're piggybacking almost all of these games.
Well,
that comes into the preparation and how, like, that is a real change in difference is how these guys are doing things. So
how did it go last time? I want to just zoom in a little bit more on that. So in 2023, and the reason I think 2023 is relevant to a certain extent is because it is the same group of people running Team USA. Right, like, DeRosa
and
is still the manager,
is similar,
and so,
which is also important.
And the schedule is similar.
The 2017 schedule was different, right?
So they carried 15 arms in 23, 7 starters and 8 relievers. And I guess Nick Martinez was kind of like, and will always be both of those things. He was kind of the swingman. So sure, 6 starters, 8 relievers, and a Nick Martinez, and a partridge in a pear tree. Right now, there are seven arms that are starters already. Excuse me, six. Six, like, starters have committed to play. Seven.
I see seven.
Skeens, yeah. Scoobel, mm-hmm. Ryan, Joe Ryan, Logan Webb, Clay Holmes, Nolan McClain, Matthew Boyd. Right? That's seven starters. And five relievers have committed. Mason Miller, David Bednar, Rays reliever Garrett Clevenger, who, like, totally understand if you don't know who that is, Griffin Jacks, Garrett Whitlock. So this, either two things are going to be true. One, the way that we think about pitching is just different already 3 years later, where it's not going to be starter and reliever. It's going to be you go out and you throw two innings. You go out and you throw three innings. And I think pitchers, even starters, are, like, more used to that being a thing because of the way that baseball has changed. Like, in the playoffs, this just happens all the time now. Whether or not these actual dudes have had to do this exercise is, like, it's easier to convince Matthew Boyd that, hey, we need you to go throw the third, the fourth, and the fifth, right? Like, that is just more commonplace. Or these are all the starters. Like, they're done, and they're just going to get three more relievers, and that'll be the roster. I think we probably get one more starter, and you see Boyd or Clay Holmes in, like, a swing role, and then they're going to try and get some of the top relievers that have yet to commit. Now, who's that going to be? Fascinated. Who do you think rounds out the bullpen?
Yeah, so I didn't prep to think about who else could join from a reliever standpoint. I would assume that they will add another left-handed pitcher. I mean, this is why I'm sure Clevenger was a target to begin with, because he is a good left-handed pitcher. Obviously, you have Scoobel now as part of this group, but I would imagine they add another lefty. And yeah, it's just how, because you're just not going to be able to script it in the same way. And yet, they probably are going to want to script it, because that's part of the other thing is, as much as these guys care about winning this tournament, they're also caring about getting ready for the season. And for starting pitchers in particular, from the moment they get to spring training, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, right? Like, this is my understanding of how this works. You are on a very specific schedule of how many pitches you are throwing each day, each outing, whether it's in a competitive setting or on the side, so that you are ready for opening day. That is the whole point of pitchers and catchers showing up early, and probably even earlier for those participating in the WBC. But you are saying, I'm throwing this many pitches on this day and this many pitches on this day. How that fits in to trying to win this tournament cannot be ignored. It is not going to be as simple as, we got Scoobel on full rest, go give us seven, big guy. Like, that is not going to happen. Now, sure, you can go back and see that Scoobel in his last spring training start last year, like, threw, I think, 85 pitches and six innings. So maybe by the time you get to the final, and I'm sure he's going to be preparing to be ready a little bit earlier, then maybe you do have that available. But the other thing is, when you have this many talented arms, like, this is where Mark DeRosa becomes a really interesting character, because now, if you have this much talent on your pitching staff, how you literally manage it, it's not like, oh, well, I mean, his options weren't great and he went to this guy. You know, and that's certainly the case for some of these other teams, right? Even the best ones, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's DR, where it's like some of their options they're going to in the bullpen are not, you know, awesome major leaguers. And it's just who you have at that point in the tournament based on the day's rest and who you used before. So I hope that all of these awesome starting pitchers get to have their WBC moment and, you know, get to all pitch great and throw, whether it's three great innings or five great innings or two great innings, whatever. But this is, it's like, great, you got the guys, and there's probably still some more coming. And how you deploy them, how you schedule them out, do you make sure that you even get far enough so that we can see all of them pitch, right? Are we guaranteed to see Scoobel and Skeens even in pool play? Who knows? That is where it gets interesting now. Again, this is still great news for the tournament from a PR standpoint, from an excitement, from a hype level. All of this is obviously great. Yeah. We can't wait. But for me, I'm just thinking about, like, all right, like, it does make DeRosa's job harder in some ways, while also making it, in theory, easier because your options are better. It raises the stakes.
The stakes because it creates more hype, first off.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. More people will tune in because of Skeens and because of Scoobel. Like, that's sweet. But you're right. Like, DeRosa can really screw the pooch down, in a way that he couldn't really last time. Like, one of the most enduring moments last round or last edition was when Venezuela played USA and Trey Turner had the grand slam. And people were angry at the Venezuela coach, but it was like, well, he brought in Silvino Bracho. And it was like, what do you want me to do? Like, Jose Alvarado's not here, right? And it's like, you're limited by your options. DeRozan's not going to be limited by his options. I think the other guys who will get asked or could be in the mix here, I think Gabe Spire gets asked, Mariners lefty reliever. I mean, I think Strom probably gets asked.
Whole Mariners team's already going, so might as well send Gabe Spire also.
Sure. Yeah. I think you'll see. It's usually like the guys that have already gotten paid a little bit are like more willing to go and be in it. Cade Smith would probably make a little sense. He's Josh Hader
Canada,
is another name. As someone who's
Team
already been
Canada,
paid.
Bro. You don't just be taking Canadian. Cade Smith's going to be closing it out for Canada. Wow. You be very careful about that, all right? You got Cade and Matt Brash are going to be shutting down the back end for the Canadians. So you can't be, listen, you got
Canadians
plenty of other choices.
Canadians are a little feisty,
there,
baby.
No, again, how are they going to prevent runs before they get to Matt Brash and Cade Smith? That's a different conversation. But Team Canada, we'll get to them as we get closer to the tournament. But I just want to say, the last thing on DeRosa, because I say that, and I do think that he becomes a very interesting character here. You know, you mentioned the Silvino Bracho thing. I mentioned those restrictions. There is going to be a lot of things happening, stuff behind the scenes. Like, teams are still going to have a role in how their players are being used, their pitchers are being used. And so I could see a situation where we're in the semifinal and it's like, why isn't he going to Mason Miller here? Or why isn't he going to, you know, whoever here? And it's because he isn't available, because again, there are going to be some restrictions here. So we have to keep that in mind when we get to that point, is that DeRosa is not going to go out before every game and be like, this is who's available, this is not, because it's a competition. And of course you want to maintain that advantage. These guys are going to stay on the roster, but that dynamic is
this
also
is
going
not
to be
Buck Showalter. This is not Buck Showalter keeping Zach Britton in the pen warming up for no reason. Like, if we don't see Mason Miller in a given spot, it's probably because the Padres have said
you're not allowed
to use him
but
in this spot.
That's the thing. We won't really know. You know, that's what's really hard is because
can you imagine? Because DeRosa's got to wear it. So, like, if there's a situation where, like, he goes to Garrett Clevenger instead of Mason Miller or something, and in the post game it goes bad, and in the post game we're like, hey, why'd you do that? He's got to be like, I just thought he was the guy for that spot. Where in reality, the answer is like, AJ Preller told me to. Like, my
dad
told me to.
Well, and also, but it's that, and again, this is happening with every team. This is not just a Team USA problem, right? Like, I know Team Venezuela has dealt with this before. I know DR has dealt with this before. To me, it's not even like, oh, why'd you go to Garrett Clevenger? Because if you have all these starters on the roster, let's say Logan Webb hasn't pitched in a week or hasn't pitched, and it's like,
gotta get him in.
Why are you, you need to win this game against, you know, DR in the semifinals. Why are you bringing in Garrett Whitlock instead of this awesome starting pitcher that's on your roster and in theory fresh? It's like, well, I mean, how important is this? I mean, we're going to see.
Yeah.
So that all of those things make the now it's about, okay, the options are there. They're on the roster. That's awesome. Now it's a totally different conversation, which is fun. It's I think part of the fun too. It also can definitely create some discourse that is going to be less fun, but in general, I'd rather these guys be on the roster than not. And for that, I think it's a great thing.
There are two specific names that I want to zoom in on a little bit, and I think we learned something from their participation. That's Nolan McLain and that's Skubal. I want to start with McLain. So McLain has thrown 8 starts in the majors, right? Comes up last year as a rookie for the Mets and immediately looks the part, one of the best pitchers over that span in the league. If not for him, the Mets would have been eliminated by the, you know, middle of August or whatever. He's awesome. And it is so interesting that, one, he is so intent on going, and that, two, the Mets are like comfortable letting him go. I think it just speaks to the type of pitcher and person that Nolan McLain is. This is not a typical rookie. This is someone who the Mets feel has advanced like far enough with their development that they're not as concerned letting them participate, right? Like, the Mets would not let Jonah Tong go play for Canada right now, in my understanding. Like, Jonah Tong needs spring training to, like, maybe he's going to end up playing. I don't know what I'm talking about. But I would be surprised, and I think Jonah Tong needs spring training to, like, learn how to be a big leaguer. Nolan McLean, just look at the man, okay? This is not a kid. This is a man. This is an adult, okay? Nolan McLean looks older than us, and we're, like, 7 years older than he is, okay? So him pitching in WBC is both surprising, and then once I think back to when I talked to Nolan McLean, and you talk to Mets people about Nolan McLean, and they're so in on this guy, it's not particularly shocking. I think he's going to be one of the breakout starts of this tournament as much as a pitcher can be. And then, of course, there's Tarek Skubal, the best pitcher on the planet, right? And I would say that his inclusion is stunning. It is downright stunning. If I was if I was Tarek Skubal's great-grandchild, I would be kind of down on this just because I'm, right? Like, I'm, okay. There's less money coming into my pocket. Okay.
Okay. Well,
everyone else in the world should be in on this. And now here's the deal.
Hold on.
Here's why I say
jumping generations ahead. You just said that. You just assumed so many things there, right? So let's talk about the decision. And well, before we get to this, and this is part of the Skubal conversation also, but I just want to reiterate this because we keep saying this phrase, and I just don't really know what it means, which is Team X letting player Y play.
Go ahead.
I have to imagine there's different situations with every player. There are rules in place that essentially allow teams to block pitchers who were on the injured list for a certain amount of time the year before that can actually like prevent them from participating. Obviously, all these pitchers were healthy and were fine. And so I still do not totally know the degree to which maybe every team is telling every player, don't go. And every player is saying, sorry, it's up to me. And it's that simple. My understanding is it's somewhere in between on that spectrum.
I think it's the following. I just want to make mostly the not.
Yeah.
I think the following is what it is. It's like if you said to your wife, hey, I'm not going to be around Friday night. I'm driving to Lake County to watch a minor league game. Your wife would either say, yeah, that's great. Like, totally. You should go do that. Like, I have plans. Or she will be like, oh, like, I thought we were going to do, like, yeah, you could go. Like, yeah, you could go and do that if you want. Like,
oh, see, where I thought this was going.
Between the lines of that, where, like, sometimes a yes is not a yes. Right? Like, sometimes a yes is a soft no.
That sounds like a great opportunity.
Yeah. Whereas, like, when I said to my wife, hey, me and Jordan are going to go to the Dominican for 4 days, she was like, oh, yeah, that sounds like a great time. Like, you should definitely go do that. Whereas the answer there could have been like, oh, really? I thought we had a Friendsgiving that weekend.
No, but let's actually take this a little bit further because it's also relevant. Let's keep going with us telling our wives we're going to do something or going somewhere. What's another thing? that they would maybe say, especially, you know, if we're going somewhere we're not used to, or maybe it's, you know, the weather's bad. Be careful, watch out, you know,
be careful.
And specifically for me, it's like, hey, you're driving home late at night and there's deer just jumping across these country roads all
just
the time.
Be careful.
Let's just be careful there, right? Okay, you're driving
keep
back in,
out.
You know, lake effect snow and it's dark. Like, let's just be careful there. So that's another thing that obviously, again, no player is like, I'm going to get hurt ever. Doesn't happen, right? So it's like, they're all like, oh, what do you mean? I'm going to be fine. I just have to prepare 2 weeks earlier and then I'll be great. And so there's, of course, elevated risks for certain pitchers than there are for position players, all these things. But as we bring it back to Skubal and what you were getting at, and we kind of wrap up this segment here, the reason it is shocking is right because of where he is in his career, which is facing the last year of his contract before free agency, which is a guy with a track record of injury, right? I mean, I know he's been, you know, Superman for the last 2 years, but he's got multiple surgeries, you know, on his arm resume. And clearly with how Skubal's been over the last 2 years, you can understand why he's like, I'm good, man. Like, that's behind me. I know how to prepare my body. I know how to be in position to succeed and to get what I need to get done to be physically prepared to do this job. And in this case, do this job for Team USA, not just for the Detroit Tigers, not just for me, Tarek Skubal, who might be in line to sign the largest free agent contract ever for a starting pitcher. All of those factors is why we assumed that there would be enough people in Skubal world being like, is this the best idea to go try and start throwing max effort pitches at the beginning of March as opposed to the beginning of April? Because it's a big difference. And we can't ignore the fact that there have been players that have gotten injured, pitchers that have gotten injured. And I'm not just talking about fluke stuff like Edwin Diaz. Like, there are examples of pitchers who have gotten hurt either later in the season, whether it's like a Drew Smyly, which, again, Mariners fans remember. There have been guys that have gotten hurt in this. And again, this is not what we want to talk about when we talk about the tournament,
but it's
part of it.
There are people with the Los Angeles Dodgers right now in that front office and in that world that genuinely believe the reason Ohtani blew out at the end of 2023 is because he was throwing max effort early in the season coming out of the bullpen. Now, whether or not that is actually the case is kind of, it's also relevant, but like, people with the Dodgers believe that, right? And I think that says something about the way Ohtani's going to be used, maybe, as a pitcher. But like, that's a real thing. It is a real risk. The risk is higher. And if Tarek Skubal wasn't a freaking dog, he would say, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to play it safe, and I'm going to put that money in my pocket, and I'm going to like increase the chance that I'm going to shatter every record for the largest pitching contract that has ever been handed out, right? And
sure.
This decision makes me like Tarek Skubal even more than I already did, right? Because I am not a Tigers fan, and my financial future is not dependent on Tarek Skubal and how much money he makes. And so I am stoked about this. Now, if you're a Tigers fan or you're Scott Harris, Tigers president of baseball operations, I think you are tentatively excited about this. And if you are Scott Boris, Tarek Skubal's agent, you can't be amped. And that brings us to a very weird edition of Skobo, Scott Boris's scoreboard.
And so that's the thing. It is unfair for us to just assume he is going to get hurt. If he didn't do the WBC, he could have gotten hurt because pitching is pitching, right? So it's not that simple. But if you think about it from the standpoint of what would you advise your client in this situation to do, it is difficult for us to imagine that Boris Korp would tell Tarek Skubal, yes, this is the best thing to do. However, let us also remember that Scott Boris works for Tarek Skubal, not the other way around.
Mm.
So if Tarek Skubal was advised by Scott Boris, hey, don't do this, and Tarek Skubal said, that's nice, I'm going to do it anyway, to your point just now, that's awesome. I kind of love that. That is great news for the casual baseball fan.
That's the likeliest scenario. I mean, we don't have inside information. Okay, I'll be Tarek Skubal. You be Scott Boris. Okay. Hey, Scott. DeRosa called. He asked if I wanted to play in the WBC. I think I really want to do it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Again, I totally understand. You're honored to have that opportunity. Don't think this is the right time. Maybe in a few years from now, I think we'd love to see you on that team once we make sure we get that big payday. You know, we're coming for that big guy. It's coming. Maybe not right now.
Scott, I appreciate that, but I'm going to not do that, and I'm going to play. I'll talk to you later.
Which brings us to the Skobo.
That's got to be
Scott
Boris
scoreboard. Is this a win for Scott Boris, who did not, I guess in theory, could have like really pulled out all the stops and like went totally nuts trying to stop him from doing this? Or is this a loss because he lost what was probably the, you know, his Skubal did not listen to him? Or do we just settle on this being a draw because ultimately you could kind of see this as being going both ways? Specifically, it's a win for all of us. We agree with that. But for Scott Boris, on his scoreboard this winter, is Tarek Skubal pitching for Team USA a win, a loss, or a draw? What do you think?
I mean, it just depends on what winning is, right? I think if Scott Boris said to Tarek Skubal, you know what, brother? I'd love to see you in the Stars and Stripes. Then it's a win. If Scott, well, I don't think that happened. If Scott Boras said, Tarek, don't do it. Don't do it. And Tarek Skubal said, I don't care what you say. I'm doing it. I think it has to be a loss because it shows that Boras's negotiation and convincing skills did not work on Scott Boras. And so as a result, I'm going to call this a draw because we just don't know. I think this is a suspended game. And if we get more reporting about it moving forward, then we can, we can,
We can change it. Well, the other funny thing is it's like, oh, maybe he's going to tell himself like, well, if he pitches well in the WBC, think about how much money. It's like, I don't think Tarek Skubal has much to prove. But maybe if he single-handedly beats Japan, you know, he'll get $420 million instead of $410 million. We'll see. All right. So Skobo, the Skobo, as we give him a draw, moves this offseason to 9 wins, 4 draws, and 9 losses. We're going to take a break. When we
Very quickly. There is an article on MLB.com from Jason Beck, who covers the Tigers. The headline is, here's how Team USA recruited Skubal for World Baseball Classic. Scott Boras' name does not show up in this article. So I don't think this is maybe every part of the story. It's interesting, though. Good story.
I am going to have to read this after, but it's like, DeRosa's like, all right, who should we get to pitch? Okay, let's someone give Tarek Skubal a call. All right, nice. Sounds good.
Should we call?
let's take a break. When we return, some transactions and some non-transactions. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecue.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Enough about a fake tournament that doesn't matter, okay? Major League Baseball is the only baseball that matters. If you know that if you listen to our podcast. So let's go around that league. We chatted quite a bit the other day about Munetaka Murakami, the Japanese slugger coming over, and how the deadline for his signing, his posting period, is rapidly approaching. And in the 3 days since, we've heard nothing. The crickets have gotten quieter somehow. The buzz has only softened in volume. And we're no closer to learning anything. The deadline is Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern. What? This is getting odd, I think, now. They're just going to tweet it out. The Braves are just going to tweet it out. The Braves are going to tweet out Munetaka Murakami to the Padres. The Braves are going to tweet that.
I would love that.
The Braves breaking other teams' news.
If you, listen, if you want more Murakami content, like we got it for you this week. Like I wrote contemplating how he would fit with every team. So you can go check that out. And I talked about why, some of the stuff I talked about earlier this pod or earlier this week on the podcast. It is bizarre. It is very strange. We will see how close to the deadline we actually get before we find out here. I still believe he will get a contract. I don't think he's going back to Japan. But at this point, it could be anything. It could be one team has just been very quietly working on a massive $150 million deal for him, or he's going to sign like a 3-year deal with a couple opt-outs and it will essentially be the biggest miss of a projection, not just for us, but for pretty much the whole industry in terms of what we expected a player to get. But that speaks to his volatility and kind of the enigma that he is. And I'm still on the high side and would absolutely take the risk here and for to kind of chase the upside. But I understand why teams are a little bit wary. So still nothing on Murakami. Maybe that changes by the time you're listening to this. Maybe, of course, but 5 p.m. Monday is coming up. So we will see there. But we did have a good amount of other actual news. And before we get to the moves that did happen, we did want to cover a little bit of reporting about a player who has not signed yet, but is a very important character this offseason, and that is Alex Bregman. We have not spent a whole lot of time on the top free agents who have lingered out there. And of course, maybe once we get into January, of course, we'll focus more as their free agencies drag on and we say, who's going to sign this guy? But Bregman is a really interesting one. And we had some reporting earlier this week that the Arizona Diamondbacks are potentially interested in Mr. Bregman's services. Now, this comes as less of a surprise as maybe as it would have a year ago when right around this time, the Snakes kind of jumped up out of nowhere and signed Corbin Burnes. In this case, it, I think, is a... Because what happened with Burnes, we're a little bit more like, okay, Diamondbacks, we can see it. We know they're willing to suddenly spend. They do have a pretty clear hole at third base, depending on how much you believe in Jordan Lawler, which at this point, certainly waning for me. But third base is a hole that we know that they want to compete. Now, it is still a little strange because we would assume that pitching would be more of a priority for Arizona. We know they signed Mike Soroka, bring back Merrill Kelly. Alex Bregman, okay, you're hearing the same things as Burnes. You know, he lives in Arizona. He's got a young kid. Would he's looking for a long-term deal that he can't seem to get anywhere else, and maybe the Snakes are the only team willing to offer him 5 or 6 years. There's also part of me that's like, is this a little bit of Scott Boras shenanigans? Let's try and bring up a team that now can be taken seriously as an actual, you know, candidate to sign Bregman. Because as I kick it back to you here, Jake, like, who are the other teams that we can consider besides the Red Sox, who are their own character, that makes sense for Bregman? Because to me, we're just recycling the same ones from last year, and I'm not any more convinced now that the Cubs or the Tigers are going to give him the long-term contract that he seeks. So I can understand why another team would emerge, whether it's legitimate or an agency ploy. I can see it with Arizona, but I don't know where you're at on Bregman.
I think if the Red Sox don't get him, they should just wrap it up. Just fold. They're that. Like, he's that important to the operation and proved himself to be in 1 year. And he fits their roster perfectly and their culture perfectly. And he's exactly the type of guy that they need. As far as who else, I agree with you. We haven't heard that much. The way that things ended with Bregman and the Tigers last winter was somewhat contentious, where Scott Harris, their president of baseball operations, said, we only want players who want to be here, which is just not really how free agency works. Now, maybe that gets papered over with, you know, legal tender. Maybe it doesn't. Do I think that the Tigers are going to spend on Bregman? No. I think they need to just keep every frickin' penny for Scooble or go all in on a player. Like, if they are going to sign Bregman, they should do like a 2-year, $80 million deal with an opt out or something, right?
But
they're not.
Bregman has no interest in that. Bregman has no interest in that right now. Bregman does not want to do free agency again. That is all. The reporting has been very consistent on that. And I believe that too. And we've seen them with a lot of free agents. And just put yourself in a situation like, yes, okay, you could keep maxing it out and getting these huge AAVs over 1 year at a time. But these are people, and they probably want to know where they're going to be and who they're going to play for the long term. And if you're Alex Bregman, you certainly feel like you've earned that. Understandably. And so I don't see that.
It's not like he needs the money. Like, he's already gotten paid. Like, he got paid by the Astros. Remember, he was not on his rookie deal. Like, he signed a real extension with Houston. Yeah. And so I do think he is looking for the time more than he's looking for the
years and the comfort.
And so, like, who's most likely to give that to him? It doesn't feel like the Red Sox, because they've been skittish of handing out super long term deals to free agent type players. Guys around the age of 30, guys like me who, you know, hurt their back when they're doing front squats at the gym, like a freaking loser. Bregman, similar lower body concerns, something to keep in mind. Who's going to give him that
money?
Lower
body or upper body?
Middle body.
You got it.
Middle body.
Middle, okay. Okay. But yeah, so Arizona has clearly thrown some money around. How does the Ketel Marte trade discussion? We haven't talked a whole lot about that on the podcast. I think that will reach a resolution here soon, whether he gets traded or they decide, hey, wait a minute, he's one of the best hitters in the sport. Let's just figure out whatever clubhouse issues we have here and move forward with Ketel Marte. I think that would be a totally reasonable path forward. Or you could trade him for a ton of stuff, because with his contract and his production, he has immense trade value. So what is their financial, you know, wiggle room? And like I said, is there another team that we're not talking about that that makes sense, that is willing to give Alex Bregman 5, 6, 7 years that has a third base need? I don't know right now. So
the Mets.
I think Alex Bregman's awesome.
The Mets should do it.
Mets, okay. Mets, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I still think it's what you said first. It's that, like, if you're not going to pony up for this guy, Boston, who you now fully understand, it's not even just, it's everything that you were saying at the press conference in spring training turned out to be correct.
And then you spent all year saying it. That's the other thing.
And then you traded Rafael Devers. And then you got rid of Rafael Devers so that you had room for Alex Bregman, because Bregman was better in all these aspects. So if he's just gone, it's like, well, what are we doing? What are you doing? What's the point? So I agree. But Bregman, we will see. That said, as we said earlier this week, if you're Boris, why is Bregman rushing to make a decision before Murakami or before all these other guys? But also, if you're Alex Bregman, you might say, like, I don't care what's going on with anyone else. If the Diamondbacks offer me 6-180, like, yeah, let's just get it done. I don't need this to linger into spring training anymore. Yeah. So who knows what the Snakes are doing? But Bregman is a good ball player.
We'll see what happens. Remember, Southwest kid, Albuquerque zone. What's that commute like?
That's true. Right down the street.
What's the drive?
Right down the street.
Right down the street.
What is the interstate that connects Phoenix and Albuquerque? Does anyone have that answer? Let us know in the comments. Let us know. Email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Have you driven from Phoenix to Albuquerque or vice versa? And is that a reasonable commute for Alex Bregman? All right, let's move on to some moves that have actually happened. We have done that drive. I don't remember how long it was. Do we want to start with the news that just happened? You know what? Let's do it. Let's be as fresh as possible. And let's talk about some reliever action. A whole bunch of relievers signed, but 5 minutes ago, according to the great Robert Murray, a reliever has been traded, and that is Matt Strom of the Philadelphia Phillies, traded to the Kansas City Royals. Now, this is funny and also makes a lot of sense. The return is apparently right-handed pitcher Jonathan Bolin. If you're not familiar with Jonathan Bolin, I don't blame you. He is a pitcher who I believe has been in the big leagues here and there for Kansas City. The Royals had kind of had a run of drafting a ton of college pitchers, and a lot of them got to the big leagues, and then not that many of them ended up being very good. In Jonathan Bolin's case, this past year was the most we saw him in the majors, mostly in relief, 34 games with Kansas City, 3.86 ERA. I wouldn't be surprised if the Phillies view him as potentially a candidate to convert back to starter, but maybe he stays in the bullpen and helps them, you know, at the back end, or they like what they see. Now, I think for Kansas City, this is kind of a no-brainer, and maybe there's more pieces going back, but Matt Strom, even though he has 1 year left, is a very good left-handed reliever. And they just traded their best left-handed reliever in Angel Zerpa to Milwaukee. And so if you're just thinking about this as a win-now move for Kansas City, this is kind of an absolute no-brainer. Am I wrong? Like, I know Matt Strom, you've seen a lot of him in Philadelphia. It's also worth mentioning that the Royals drafted Matt Strom, didn't they? I believe that was like over a decade ago. Yes. But I believe Matt Strom debuted with Kansas City. He obviously was not what he is now. But now he goes back there and kind of fills the role that was just vacated by Zerpa. So I kind of like it for Kansas City. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's a weird one. It's weird for the Phillies because Strom has been a high leverage component of their bullpen for the last few years. And even though they signed Brad Keller this week to bolster that group, you still felt like the Phillies, as we've seen, needed as many high-end bullpen arms as they could get. I remember, I think Dave Dombrowski was asked during the Adolis Garcia press conference the other day about the bullpen mix, and he was like, I think we like where we're at. We have enough high-leverage guys that we trust. And I just guess Strom didn't fit. There has to be more to this, in my opinion. And by more to this, I don't mean more coming back. Like, I think that there's either, like, Strom didn't fit in the room, which totally, like, I never really got that sense. I think that maybe the Phillies are going to now use this money and go get someone else.
It's financial. That's what I see it as.
It feels like there's another shoe to drop here.
Yeah, I would say to me, it has to do with, I mean, he was probably projected to make what, $8 million in his final year of ARB? Maybe more than that? $7.5 million.
He wasn't ARB.
$7.5 million.
It was an ARB.
Oh, right. He had signed a contract. Right. So $7.5 million. So $7.5 million is, I mean, he's worth it for what he's been for them for sure. But yeah, if they're trying to move some money around, if they are focused on the luxury tax, if they're going to make another, you know, move, like, yeah, $7 million when your payroll's that high is not a small amount of money. And so I would have to imagine that's where it is. Whereas, you know, Bolin's on the minimum. And if they think that he can give you similar production and kind of fill that role, obviously he's right-handed and a very different pitcher than Strom. But I wouldn't be surprised if they just really like Jonathan Bolin. And they wanted to get off the money and save $7 million. And they just signed Brad Keller, who I love that signing, 2 for $22 million. We'll get to two other 2 for $22 million contracts here in a second. But yeah, Brad Keller was a really interesting guy. I mean, you look at what he did with the Cubs. I didn't really notice it until like mid-August. And I was like, holy crap, like this guy's been unbelievable for them. And I could see him. It sounds like there was some talk. So, could you move him back to a starter? Makes sense to keep him in the bullpen. I think he fits great there. And so obviously left-handed wise, now it's just,
so let me hop in. Reliever? The one other thing to consider, the one other thing to consider here is Tanner Banks kind of emerging as a trustworthy piece, right?
Yeah.
He's the guy who throws lefty. Yep. They didn't necessarily need three lefty arms that you trust is a lot. So if you really think Jonathan Bolin's good, like whatever, trade Matt Strom. Like, fine.
Yeah. They took Zach McCambly in the Rule 5-2, which you don't always see the Phillies operating with the Rule 5. So maybe that's another pitcher that they think can fill in on the back end. So which again, that's another move of like, we need a cheaper pitcher. You know, not necessarily one that we know as much, but it's like, that those are moves. If you're taking a Rule 5 pitcher, if you're swapping Strom for Jonathan Bolin, like those are like, okay, maybe you are caring about where the money is. And maybe that tells me that they're done adding anything major this offseason, which Dombrowski essentially said. I know he said that a few times and then it's continued to make another big trade or another signing. So we will see where that goes. As I mentioned, Brad Keller was not the only pitcher that signed for 2 years and $22 million. And again, we're going to get to the Padres here in a second because Michael King is a much bigger contract than these. But let's just go through the reliever movement before we go back to San Diego. Luke Weaver follows Devin Williams from the Bronx to Queens. He also gets 2 years and $22 million. I think the interesting thing about Luke Weaver, especially in relation to Devin Williams, and now it's funny because now they're just both still on the same team. The narrative about Devin Williams' struggles in New York were understandable because of how bad it was when it was bad. But if you look at the trajectory of the season, Devin Williams got his stuff together and was fantastic for the last 2 months. Whereas Luke Weaver, after he came back from, I believe it was either an oblique or a hamstring injury in June, was kind of awful for like the entire second half. And because he had built up a lot more goodwill with New York, there was a lot more, it was overlooked a little bit more. He wasn't getting as much, you know, grief from Yankees fans. And the focus was not on him because people knew him and he had earned so much of it in 2024. But in terms of how they finished the season, like Luke Weaver was not someone that I think was not someone good. I would be excited to bring in. And his upside certainly did not have anywhere the track record of Devin Williams. Now they are both on the Mets, which is very funny. And I think the Mets certainly still needed more relievers. They, of course, did not get Robert Suarez or any of the other top-end guys. We know Edwin Diaz is gone. And we can run through some of these other names. This market is thinning out in a hurry. There are really not a lot of late-inning guys left that have not been signed. Really, Pete Fairbanks and Sir Anthony Dominguez are the biggest ones still remaining. And they might be signed by the time you're listening to this. So, you know, this is fine. I mean, I think Luke Weaver can be good if it was a health issue and maybe a pitch tipping issue. That's fine. Obviously, the Mets can afford 2 for $22 million pretty easily. So I don't know. You were around Luke Weaver and you saw Devin Williams too. What do you make of both of these guys now becoming Mets?
Dude, Luke Weaver is a delight when he is good and he's like feeling himself.
Yep.
Awesome cat. Very enjoyable to talk to. Fun interview to watch and participate in. I think the Mets can kind of help him get back on track. he just didn't, like, his body was out of sync after the injury too. Like, when you have someone who, this is particularly true with pitchers, if you're good, you get hurt, and then you come back and you're bad, even if you are, like, healthy, your biomechanical being, right, can get out of whack. And I think that that's kind of what happened, and he just never got back to where he was. As far as these other signings go, Giants, Jason Foley, Rangers, they will try to fix you, Chris Martin, Reds, Caleb Ferguson, Cubs, Caleb Thielbar, Angels trying to build a bullpen, Jordan Romano, Andrew Pomeranz, Guardians signed Sean Armstrong. One of these guys, like, one of these guys will be good, like, really, really good, and will be super relevant. Of all of these, the most interesting one to me is the Guardians spending $5.5 million on Sean Armstrong. Last offseason, they did something similar. They gave Paul Sewald $7 million. He was terrible for them. Sean Armstrong's fine.
Well,
the Guardians spending any of their budget on, like, a veteran reliever just does not make sense to me.
That point, I completely agree with. However, you should look at the season that Sean Armstrong just had, because I've doubted this guy for a long time because he's bounced around and he's not particularly a fun watch in terms of just, like, wow, his stuff is unbelievable. I know the sweepers is pretty solid, but you should look at the season that Sean Armstrong just had, because I thought he could have gotten maybe more money from this. Now, more money than this. Now, I don't know why Cleveland is the team to do it, because obviously you would think they would need other stuff more than relief pitching, but I feel a lot better about Sean Armstrong than Paul Sewald at this point last year. So I will just say that. And then the one other team I do want to hit on before we go to the San Diego moves is San Francisco. They gave Adrian Houser 2 years and $22 million. Now, Adrian Houser is a starter. Very weird year for Adrian Houser. You know, started, had a very good start to the season with the White Sox, and then was traded to the Rays for reasons I still don't totally understand. But the Giants need a lot of pitching. They are a team that clearly is, I thought, needed a lot more relief help than Jason Foley and Sam Hinch's, and there's not a lot of options out there left. They seem to be messaging and communicating, and all the reporting is that they're not really interested in throwing around a lot more money. But there's some massive holes on this team, and it's kind of, I assumed that the Tony Vitello hire would be the beginning of an offseason where we were talking a lot about the Giants. And that has just not been the case. Yeah. I wrote yesterday about just kind of the five biggest questions facing the Giants and just some of the roster holes that they have, whether it's second, whether it's, you know, one of the corner outfield spots, and whether it is the bullpen and the rest of the rotation, which behind Webb and Robbie Ray is just not a group of arms I'm super excited about. So maybe they're just waiting for a deal to fall in their lap and they are going to spend some more money, but I'm really perplexed about how Mr. Pobozzi has operated so far. And there are a lot of arms still out there to sign that could fit here, more so in the rotation than in the bullpen. But I really am not seeing the vision here in San Francisco. And as excited as I am for the Tony V experience, I'm not really sure what they're going to do that's going to make me really excited about their chances in the NL West or in the NL wild card even going into 2026 as things stand. But a lot of offseason left.
All right, let's move to the Padres, who have done some things. Okay.
Sure have.
Tristan McKenzie, kind of a funny place to start. Michael King, 3 years, $75 million. He has opt-outs after this season and the next. King was dealt to the Padres in the Juan Soto deal, was brilliant for them in 2024, had some injury issues in 2025, never really got rolling. How many starts did he make? Like 11? 10?
Yeah, I don't even...
For the 2025 sure Padres? But he gets paid here. Now, he gets paid here because there's talent still in this arm. How many starts did he make, Jordan?
Oh, yeah. 15. 15, and then the weirdest thing is that because, again, some of the injuries and the work, he appeared out of the bullpen in the wild card series against the Cubs, which is kind of a strange situation. But anyway, yeah, I mean, 73 innings, right? Man, I mean, what he looked like at the end of 24,
start against the Braves in the wild card round was like as good of a
one of the better
the stuff was nuts.
Yes. Yes. Now that said, you look at his track record and you know that 173 innings in 2024 is so far and away his healthiest, his biggest workload. He threw 100 and 104 in 2023. And other than that, of course, he was kind of bouncing back and forth between the bullpen and the rotation. So he just, the talent is there. That's why the AAV is high. But this was not someone that teams were going to feel comfortable giving 4, 5, or 6 years. And so I think for player and team, it made sense for him to get a contract of this structure. That said, did I think that the Padres were going to find $25 million to give him right now? No, not at all. I thought there were other teams that would happily give him this contract, and it sounds like there were many that were interested. And a Padres team that, by all accounts, is going to have to move some money to make this even this work, just decides to make this deal happen and figure out the rest later. They obviously need starting pitching. We assumed King was going to be gone. They still need more starting pitching, I think, and maybe if there's another trade, they're going to need even more. The Padres are just bizarre. I think they are going to remain a main character. We know Preller has all kinds of crazy stuff cooking. I think Padres fans got to be excited that they get to keep Michael King, because he certainly had some pretty big moments for them, and the upside is undeniable. So if they do believe they can keep him healthy, then that's a great starting pitcher to have. But I am surprised that he ended up back there for a lot of reasons.
Being a Padres fan must be so weird, because it's like you can't, but it's harder to like complain about this era of roster construction after you spent 10 years as like the most irrelevant team in the sport, and then because of an influx of money from a good owner became must-see TV and the place is packed and the team is fun, you know? But to grow attached to players must be so odd, because you're like, oh, sweet, Michael King's back. Are we going to trade Manny Machado, though? Like, what is the team going to be? You can't feel any way about any offseason or trade deadline until it's totally done, because you just, yeah. Preller is so volatile. And it's just such a must be a fascinating experience for them. Anything else on that? Or do you want to go ahead and take
it? Not on King. I mean, they also signed a Korean infielder, Sungmoon Song, who's coming off a big season with the Kiwoom Heroes. And I mean, it's not going to be a huge contract. Sounds like 3 years, maybe $13 million. But he is someone, while he's not the highest profile as some of these other Japanese players that we've talked about, I mean, the status of the bench, Padres, and the depth just doesn't exist. And so any kind of talent with upside that they can kind of add to this position player group on the relative cheap, it is not surprising that they decided to pursue that. So kind of an unknown, but I'm excited to see what Mr. Song can do in Major League Baseball. All right. I think we should take a break. When we return, we have the good, the bad, the ugly, and maybe a few more moves. We'll be right back on Baseball Bar. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Two more quick moves before we get to the good, the bad, the ugly. The Washington Nationals make their first major league free agent signing of the offseason, agreeing to a deal with left-handed pitcher Foster Griffin for 1 year and $5.5 million, continuing the trend of this winter of pitchers coming back from Asia after pitching quite well over there, whether that was a Cody Ponce, whether that was an Anthony Kay, whether that was a Ryan Weiss. Now we have Foster Griffin, who has been terrific for the Giants, I believe, right? I believe he's been on Yomi Yuri for the last couple of years. And let's just see what the Nationals with Sean Doolittle and Simon Matthews can cook up for Foster Griffin, a former first-round pick, I believe, many moons ago out of a Florida high school. Had some time in the big leagues, and we will see what the Nationals can do with Foster Griffin. Now, most people, Foster Griffin did not have anything on Foster Griffin or the Nationals before we go to Tyler Austin?
No. I mean, I have Ani Kalambi thoughts. The Nats hired Ani Kalambi as their general manager. Ani, who is 1 year older than us, Grandpa. Awesome dude. We've talked to him a couple of times. He was in Tampa for a while, then was in AGM with the Phillies. Was last 4 years been very involved in kind of some of the stuff behind the scenes with the Phillies. And then taking the number two job at the Washington Nationals. Continuing a trend of the Washington Nationals hiring millennials, baby, let's go. 31 years old. God. Ani, who grew up an internet baseball dork like us, Ani was a frequent commenter on the McCovey Chronicles way back in the day as someone who grew up a Giants fan. He, like, knows what weird baseball is. Like, this is a good dude for me as a D.C. resident to have around, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, I remember talking to him about backyard baseball, if I recall correctly, when we met him down in Clearwater, I believe is when that was. But yeah, so congrats to Ani. Very cool that he gets that gig.
As far as it pertains to Nats fans, like, are the Nats going to be good in 2026? No. But every single hire that they have made, from coaching staff to front office, has me probably too excited about their future, right, is what I would say.
Yep. That is a good way to say it. One more signing. Another player returning from overseas, Tyler Austin. Oh, my goodness. It's been a long time since we saw this guy in the majors. A very shockingly important part of the Baby Bombers Yankees movement in 2016, 2017, 2018. It did not exactly work out for Tyler Austin in the majors, but he went overseas and he became an absolute force for the Bay Stars and NPB. He's dealt with a lot of injuries, but when he's been on the field, he has been one of the best hitters in that league. He's now 34, so he's not exactly coming back necessarily in his physical prime. But the Chicago Cubs have signed him to a one-year major league deal to, I guess, fill a DH role, maybe a platoon with young slugger Moises Ballesteros, first base DH. Kind of a weird one for the Cubbies. Again, another sign where they're probably not exactly, throwing cash around. I didn't realize Tyler Austin was coming back. I thought he would just be hitting homers in Japan until he was 40. But now he is back in Major League Baseball. And I don't know if the Cubs go to New York this year, but I look forward to the confused ovation that Yankees fans will give Tyler Austin if he ever returns to Yankee Stadium. That will be very funny.
When I was on my honeymoon in Japan at the beginning of this year, I went to the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame, and like there was a Tyler Austin jersey in there because he was like the MVP of the finals. And I was like, hey, there he is.
Let me just quickly check. Are the Cubs going to the Yankees? They're going to the Mets, so that's not the Yankees, August.
Not the Yankees. Even more confusing. You're a Yankees fan at the Mets game. And Tyler Austin's there. Do you cheer?
Yes, the Yankees are going to Chicago. So Tyler Austin is going to have to either get traded to another team that's going to the Bronx or stick around for long enough and return. So I hope we see Tyler Austin play another game in Yankee Stadium. All right, Jake, it's time for the good, the bad, the ugly. Why don't you start us off? What is good for you? Oh, I see this on the document. This does fire me up. What do we got for good this week?
So, for you longtime listeners, you know that Jordan and I missed being fans of stuff. And so we decided to be Sabres fans. That's right. The Buffalo Sabres are our favorite hockey team. And I've been pretty tuned in. They're on a W4 right now and fired their longtime general manager to hire a new one. Shouts out Jarmo Kekäläinen. But the Burrs are looking all right. One of the most tormented teams in the NHL, if not the most. It's been a long run of woe for our Sabres. And that is starting to turn, maybe, as this week, one Mr. Ernie Clement was the guest drum banger at the Sabres game. You know, as many of these teams do, they have someone come and bang a drum. And it was Ernie Clement, the pride of Rochester, New York, the upstate mafia. Most of them are just fans of both the Sabres and the Bills. And so Ernie rolled up, drove across an hour west to Buffalo to bang the drum and enjoy some Sabres hockey. I'm jealous I wasn't there. I think taking in a Sabres game with Ernie Clement would bid on that at a silent auction for myself,
Right. I mean, I don't know. I think we should just try to pull that off without having to win an auction to do it. But we are still contemplating our first journey to go check out our Burrs. But it has been, again, it's a new era here. In Yarmo We Trust, shouts out to Ernie Clement. My good this week is a fascinating bit of news from the world of Japanese baseball, as this is another name that we are about to learn a lot about. And I believe it is pronounced Gene Sato. G-E-N-E-I. Sato. He is a right-handed pitcher at Sendai University. Yes, they have college baseball in Japan. It is quite good. But Sato, one of the hardest throwers in Japan, I believe he's been up to 99, has decided, you know what? I'm going to America, and I'm going to go pitch in Division I baseball. Sato has decided he will transfer to a Division I school in February with the intention of becoming draft eligible in 2027. So it does not sound like he's going to transfer in time to pitch in the spring, but it sounds like he's going to enroll at a D1 school in the U.S. and then pitch somewhere in the summer in the U.S. and then just get drafted in MLB in 2027. This is sure fascinating. We've talked about Rintaro Sasaki, who came over before he even played in college in Japan. A big, left-handed slugger who came to Stanford. He has not necessarily, been awesome so far over here stateside, and his draft stock has certainly dimmed a little bit, but he's still at Stanford and still trying to, make his way into pro ball. But a pitcher like this coming over and potentially being a character in college baseball in America is very exciting. So, Gene Sato. If I'm pronouncing that wrong, Yuri, and you're listening to this, please let me know. But you could check out our pal over at Yaku Cosmo, who's been tweeting all about this. Just a fascinating story, and I can't wait to kind of follow where he ends up. If he ends up at Stanford with Rintaro, if he goes to the SEC, who I imagine there's SEC schools trying to throw all kinds of NIL money at this guy because he looks like he could be pretty good. I can't wait to see what happens with this. So another development in the world of Japanese baseball becoming more relevant on this side of the globe.
I want him to sign with like the funniest cultural fit. Like I want like Ole Miss or something like
Sato at Oxford.
I want this to get wonky.
Yeah.
Wonky. All right. Bad. John
man,
Meeks.
What's bad?
This is a,
oh God,
like a bummer's bummer. John Meeks is like one of the best dudes. 80 grade guy. 80 grade guy having an 80 grade bad time. So John Meeks, all-star with the Orioles in 2021. And it's like, wow, when the Orioles get good again, John Means will be a part of the rotation. Instead, he got TJ in 2022, worked his way back, blew out again, had to get another TJ in 2024, signed with the Gardos last year, was like making his way back towards the end of the year. Didn't get on the mound in the big leagues, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, pitched in the minors, but didn't get to the majors.
Pitched in the minors. Yeah. Was ready to like sign with the team. Like he woke up the day of and was going to sign with a team, and that day while training tore his freaking Achilles and now is not signing with that team. And it just sucks. It's like a unbelievable thing that happened to him. The odds of it are so small. If he had just torn his Achilles like the next day, he would have been due. Now he's going to be fine financially. He has made more money than we have, but it just sucks. That's not what it's about. It's about this guy pitching on the big league mound again. Thoughts with John and the Meads family. Like, this is just a huge bummer. Hopefully he makes it back and throws in the bigs in the future.
My bad this week is Jonkenzie Noel being DFA'd before Christmas. Now, I will say, sort of something I've been mentally preparing for a while, because Jonkenzie Noel, bless his heart, an absolute delightful young man who I've enjoyed chatting with in his time in Cleveland, obviously had that huge swing off of the aforementioned Luke Weaver in the 2024 postseason. However, if you were not paying attention to Jonkenzie Noel this year, that is okay. He had one of the worst offensive seasons that we've seen in quite some time. It was really, really bad. He struck out 34% of the time and hit 162 in 153 plate appearances. That is not good enough to remain on this Guardians roster, so he has been DFA'd. However, Big Christmas, being DFA'd before Christmas, is devastating. I hope someone else gives him a chance. Maybe he just gets outrighted. That's even more bad and sad, but we will see. But I wish, whatever is next for Jonkenzie, I hope that he can find some happiness and success, whether that is on the baseball field or elsewhere, because he's still 24 years old. So I hope that there is more baseball in his future. I just am not so sure it's going to be in Cleveland.
It's not yet time for him to go to Japan or Korea, but boy, oh boy, whenever that time comes, John Kenzie,
they will welcome him.
Do not hesitate to make the leap, because that league is for you. My Ugla is related to another sport. JJ Redick, former podcaster, current head skipper of the Los Angeles basketball Dodgers, was doing a post-game press conference the other day talking about, my understanding is like teams were picking the Lakers play calls. My understanding of Redick is that he's a very analytical type coach and they run a lot of plays and picks and sets and whatever in their system. And he said, quote, "I don't know if you guys watch baseball, but you know the third baseman giving all the hand signals? That's something we've been working on so that we don't run into the situation we ran into in Philly where I'm trying to call a play. Guys don't know what they're doing." So starting a sentence with, "I don't know if you guys watch baseball," and then being wrong about baseball is both hilarious and seems very JJ Redick to me. I like the cut of his jib, JJ Redick, but he seems like someone who talks with the confidence of someone who has never once thought that they were wrong about something, and that maybe rubs a lot of people the wrong way about JJ Redick. And so for him being like, "I don't know if you guys watch baseball," but maybe he is just a super duper ball knower and is talking about like defensive positioning signs. Like when I was in college,
that's giving him a lot of credit.
Our shortstop would give pick signs to the pitcher after on every pitch when there was a runner on second. It was like certain things was like, "Hey, that's one look, no pick. Two looks, pick. Inside move, no look." Like we were getting those signs, so maybe that's what he means. But I think what he really thinks he's saying is the third base coach giving the signs. But I'm laughing at the idea of the third baseman telling the hitter to bunt.
Yeah, I guess I will excuse, because he probably just, you know, misspoke, but it does lead to a very, very funny sentence. I agree. So, Ugla indeed. My Ugla, shout out to emailer Nathan, who just lobbed this one up to me, and I'm going to slam it home here on Baseball Barbacast. This is an awesome story. I don't know if you saw this email from Nathan. This is about White Sox minor league pitcher Duncan Davitt, who was traded to the White Sox from the Rays in exchange for Adrian Hauser. How timely. Duncan Davitt is spending his offseason covering high school sports for his local newspaper in Iowa. Now, it is not uncommon for minor league players who have not made any money, didn't sign for anything, to just have jobs in the offseason that are just very normal jobs. Working at a grocery store, delivering Amazon packages, you know, like, there's all kinds of jobs that guys are doing that have nothing to do with being a baseball player, because while minor league players make more than they used to, they still don't make very much. So that is not that weird. However, to spend time at local high school basketball games and writing very, very long recaps of the Indianola boys and Norwalk girls, both of which are undefeated this season. Congratulations to them. For the Independent Advocate, this is in Iowa, I believe Indianola, Iowa, it's just awesome. Duncan Davitt, who again reached AAA, like probably going to be a major league pitcher this upcoming season, and is just spending time grinding these game stories of high school basketball.
Being a ball writer.
Just delightful. Yeah, I mean, this guy, he's getting the access, which is cool. And I watched a little video of him interviewing, and he gave a very wholesome answer, which is basically like, these kids are not going to get, like, he remembers what it was like to see his name basically in the local newspaper. And like, he wants to still give these kids that opportunity. But the funniest part of the video of him at the game is that he's wearing his Beverly Hills Sports Council pullover, which is, of course, one of the top agencies in baseball. So he's still reminding everyone, like, "Look, folks, like I'm still a pro ball player here. Just because I'm typing away about, Nodaway Valley and Lincoln and Oskaloosa," and I'm just reading all kinds of Iowa high school names here. He's like, no, don't forget. I got plus command of multiple pitches, and I'm going to be a major league pitcher this year. So
Duncan Davitt, come on the
pod.
Thank
you, Nathan, for emailing us.
Let's talk leads. You know, Let's talk post-game scrum questions. Let's get into the nitty-gritty. And whenever you're done throwing, come over to the BBWAA.
Yeah.
Be the first. Sounds like the first player. Has there ever been a big leaguer in the BBWAA?
I would think, but it's probably been decades.
A while.
Like, I think that that is probably something that happened in like the 50s, 60s, 70s. Great question.
When like writing about baseball? When writing about baseball paid better than playing the baseball?
Well, even if it was out, whatever. All the I good know old is days. That I trust Duncan Davitt on hoops more than I trust JJ Redick on hardball. All right. That's it. We podcasted. We will not be back. I will not be back next week because I'm taking all next week off. So you will hear from Jake later next week. Tuesday, we're going to have a bit of a best of show. So you can look forward to that. I'm sure Jake will have plenty of news to talk to about at the end of next week. But until then, thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. You will hear from me again in a couple of weeks. Thank you all for listening. We appreciate it. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. Another fun week of podcasting. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for joining me. And we will talk to you all very soon. Bye-bye.
And if you really need to get a hold of Jordan, you can call him at